Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
Welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And Tim, we've got a really kind of unnerving theater of the mind for tonight. It's in. You did a fantastic job with this episode as well. But man, that one really gave me the heebie-jeebies. I don't know about you.
A little bit, yeah.
You know, you keep hearing people's stories long enough, and once in a while you get these ones that start off one way. And really set you on edge, and then just unnerving. You guys are in for a treat today a little bit later on in the program. But first up, we're going to be talking about identified flying objects, a multidisciplinary academic approach to the UFO phenomenon. Joining us today on the program is Dr. Michael Masters. He is a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Tech in Butte, Montana. He received a PhD in anthropology from The Ohio State University in 2009, where he specialized in hominin evolutionary anatomy, archaeology, and biomedicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Masters. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I got to tell you, I was excited when I saw the outline of your book and the information, because this is something Tim and I have been talking about for a long time, or at least a concept we've been talking about for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I'm intrigued to hear your take on this. So let's begin. First of all, how do you go from biology and anthropology and biomedicine to examining UFO stories and yeah. what they might actually mean? What's that? How does that leap take place for you?
Well, I mean, it's kind of been a lifelong question for me, to be honest. Ever since I was a young kid and I first heard a story of my father's encounter with the UFO, I just really started looking into it more, and kind of had this moment when I was 8 years old where I kind of got this little flash that occurred when I looked up at the book Communion by Whitley Strieber that my father bought and was sitting up on the shelf, and just kind of saw this sort of connection between, you know, our ancient hominin ancestors. I mean, I was 8, so I just kind of saw it as like a chimpanzee type form at the time, ourselves, and then this alien on that book cover. And just wondered if there could be a relationship there, and spent the better part of the rest of my life kind of researching that. Ended up getting a PhD in biological anthropology and really studying the deep evolutionary history of our ancestry, our human evolutionary past. And there's a lot of things within it, just long-term trends that if they continued into the future would seem to result in something that looks very much like the most commonly described alien form. And then I, you know, started to look into the time travel aspects of it and delve deeply into physics and the physics of time and time travel. And really, the more I went down that rabbit hole of inquiry, the more things just started to make sense in this context of the alien UFO phenomenon being us in the future, as opposed to being extraterrestrial.
Right. That's a fascinating aspect of this whole story. And it seems to me to make more sense, which I know sounds ridiculous when we start bringing in the concept of time travel. But, you know, for most of our listeners, they think, wait, so you'll believe that we can time travel back to the past, but we, you know, there aren't aliens visiting our planet. Let me start off, if we could go back, your father's experience. How old was he when he had this experience? And was it just a one off, or did he have multiple viewings?
Well, I wasn't actually even born yet. It was before I was born, but when I was about 7 or 8 years old, I vividly remember being on the stairs, eavesdropping into a conversation that they were having with some friends that were over, and he was describing this encounter. He's a veterinarian, and we're from a very rural part of Ohio and Amish country. And it was a dark night, and this ball of light was over the horizon. And he actually had a friend with him at the time, a colleague that was riding along on this farm call, which on J. Allen Hynek's scale would give it a little bit more credence because there was another witness there. But this ball of light just came flying at him and stopped right in front of the truck, and then kind of moved around a little bit, zipped back across the horizon, and according to him, it just shot straight up and disappeared from sight. So I wasn't alive at the time this happened, and it was just that one event. But I've, you know, asked him about it many times since, and my mother as well, because he was, you know, relaying this back over the CB radio to my mom, who handled all the calls that would come in. And it was just that one event, but it I guess impacted me in a way that I wanted to know more about it.
Did he seem, now, you know, knowing your dad, was he ever the type to exaggerate or maybe misinterpret things? You know, a lot of us have those people in our life. They'll, you know, they'll see a water spot on the ground and swear it's Jesus's face, you know, but right. what can you tell us honestly about your father? And I know none of us want to besmirch their thoughts or memories, but in all honesty, does this resonate with you that what he saw is what he really saw?
Yeah, it does. He's a very religious man. I don't think he really liked having the experience or trying to figure out what it was or how it fit into his overall worldview. But no, he's never been one to embellish anything. He's kind of a serious person. He's an equine practitioner. He's a veterinarian that works on horses. So there was never really any reason why he would, you know, make something up like this. And he never really even talked about it, to be honest. I the only time I ever heard about it was that one time over here in that conversation, and then just when I asked him about it years later. So, no, I definitely believe that this happened to him. And even beyond that, I mean, in researching all of these other encounters and experiences that other people had as part of the research for this book, I was, amazed at the consistency among them, like how commonly the same sort of form of this craft is described in the same form of these, what I refer to as extra tempestrials, making reference to the time and the temporal aspect of it. But there's so much consistency across all of these different accounts, including his. It fits very neatly into all of these different accounts. And obviously there's outliers, and there's going to be ones that are embellished or made up. But the ones that have been vetted and really truly looked into throughout the last 50, 60 years seem to be quite consistent across the board.
Is your area known for UFO sightings? You know, there are a few hotspots here and there throughout every state, it seems. Is that area known to have a lot of that activity?
I don't think so. I mean, I live in Montana now, and a pretty unpopulated part of Montana. I guess you could say that about most of the state, but I don't really remember much growing up in Ohio. I've been out here for 10 years, and there is actually I think it's called the Maelstrom Air Force Base. It's a nuclear silo here in Montana, and that actually is a hot spot. That has reports of sightings that come out pretty regularly. But around the rest of the state, actually, I did an interview on Fade to Black 6 months ago or so, and there was a woman that contacted me from Missoula, which is about an hour and a half away, and she said that there's an area not far from where her cabin is where there's activity at least, you know, a couple of times a month or so. So yeah, there does seem to be a few hot spots in and around here. But I've never actually seen one. I'm kind of bummed about that, to tell you the truth. I think it'd be pretty cool to witness this firsthand, and especially to interact with, you know, with these future humans, in some capacity. The amount we could learn, the amount I could learn, especially being, you know, having studied our evolutionary history, both cognitively, morphologically, physically, genetically, just to be able to see, you know, that these various future forms of ourselves. I mean, my research is studying the past, studying these past hominin forms, and then, you know, obviously seeing where we are now. But these glimpses of these aliens, these extraterrestrials, sort of fill in another important stage of that knowledge.
In the area where your father had the sighting, did you say there was a military base near there?
No, the military base is out here in Montana. I'm pretty sure it's called Malmstrom Air Force Base.
I know. I was just curious, you know, because there are so many sightings, you said, in that area in Montana where that base is. It seems a lot of sightings seem to be centered around nuclear power plants or military installations, which, again, flies in the face of logic. If you're an alien being and you don't want to get messed with, why would you put yourself over one of the
right,
you know, hot button territories where they're going to be watching and protecting that the most?
Absolutely.
I was just wondering if there was any kind of base near your home or near where your father had originally had his eyewitness sighting.
No, I'm guessing they were just there to mutilate some cows or something. I really don't know. It's a pretty rural area. There's not much going on in Amish country at all in that part of Northeast Ohio. But yeah, they do seem to be pretty commonly sighted around these military bases. But at the same time, I mean, if we're talking about future technology and the rate at which technology evolves, I doubt they have any reservations about getting caught or, you know, being apprehended or anything like that. It'd be like if we went back with our, you know, F-16 fighter jets to, you know, 200 years ago. They're not going to be able to do anything to us with their technology from that time either. So why they're doing it, I have no idea. I mean, I don't know what there is about these nuclear bases or military bases that are of such interest, but there do seem to be a lot of really valid reports coming from each of these different locations.
You talk about the fact that you look into the history of humans, of beings that have been here. Are there any strange, you know, that we've heard about the missing link? I don't know how truthful that really is. If there is really, at this point in our history, still a version of us we can't seem to, you know, match things up to. Is that a truth at this point?
No. If you hear the term missing link, it's usually just something that it's someone that doesn't really understand the deep evolutionary history of our species and all of the, you know, ancestral species that came before. It's sort of an archaic term that still gets thrown around, usually by people that don't really understand it or don't want to understand it. But we can go back to the time that we shared a common ancestor with chimpanzees about 7 million years ago. And from that point on, when we first stood upright and became bipedal, as we call it, habitual upright walking, we kind of started this new path. And what we look for as paleoanthropologists, and I've worked on a number of digs throughout the world with our past human ancestors, some from 3.5 million years ago, a Neanderthal site in southern France at almost 200,000 years ago. And the main thing we look for is that upright walking characteristic. When we find bones, we can see, and I would say 95% of our bones, whether or not we stood upright. And if we were upright at that time, it indicates that we're a part of this lineage, what we call the hominin lineage. So since that time, since we became hominins, there really are no gaps. There's not really a period where we just don't have anything, and there's no big jumps that take place. And the big problem with this is that it comes down to labeling. It comes down to classification, that we have to classify when we kind of have these different traits. And so we give these hominin species a different species classification, but that doesn't mean that there was a jump there, a big change. It was still a continuous change over time. We just have to recognize these identifiable morphological traits and then give it a different classification. But no, at this point, we have a very, very deep understanding, not just of our morphology and our physiological changes, but also our culture and our cultural changes going back to about 3 million years ago with the first stone tools.
And, you know, there's also been a lot of conversation over the years doing this for 13 years of people speculating that our physiology doesn't seem necessarily suited for this planet, that they believe that there's been some kind of genetic DNA splicing or something that, you know, seems to be part of us would appear to be extraterrestrial or at least make sense to have been extraterrestrial at some point, and we've slowly adapted. In looking at the real science, which is so great to have somebody that can actually break that down for us, do you see any strange anomalies in us that might give you that concept or belief that maybe we didn't originate here?
No, not at all. I mean, the first thing I would add is well, then where did we come from? You know, what planet is so much better suited for what we look like and what our physiological form is, that it's somehow better than here or close enough that this could even happen? Or why Earth? Or why, if we were put here, would we be so closely related to chimpanzees and orangutans and gorillas and all of the other primates if we didn't share a close phylogenetic link with them, if we weren't evolutionary related to them? And it's not just, you know, I mentioned 7 million years ago, between 6 and 8 million years ago when we first started walking upright, but even going back beyond that, you know, you can go all the way back to the origin of primates 60 million years ago, or before that, you know, we still had mammals during the time of the dinosaurs. We lived underground and would only come out at night because they would eat us otherwise. But once the dinosaurs were disappearing, our mammalian ancestors came out from underground and diversified into all of these other ecological niches during what's known as an adaptive radiation. And from that point on, we can see this long continuity evolving from kind of a little tree shrew looking mammal into more complex primates, much like the lemurs and lorises of today, and then into increasingly more complex primates over that roughly 30 to 40 million year time period. And then really when it starts to become human or human-like is that point where we diverged with the common ancestor of chimpanzees around 7 million years ago. So there's not really any point even beyond when we became bipedal that we would appear to be, that long process would appear to be interrupted or usurped by some other form that came from somewhere else. And I'll be the first to admit that we're not very well suited to this form of locomotion, our bipedalism. I talk about this in the book quite a lot, that it's an evolutionary trade-off. There are a lot of negatives of our upright walking, what we call the perils of bipedalism. However, there's a lot of benefits too. The fact that our hands became available to make and use tools was huge. Our brain sizes largely got bigger because we stood upright and our heads had to rotate down in order to see where we were going. And that flexed our basic cranium, the part of the skull where the brain sits. And that allowed more space to open up at the top of our skull in what we call the calvarium or neurocranium. So all of these things kind of came together largely because we just stood up and started walking upright. So there's not really any indication of outside extraterrestrial influence. And honestly, we don't need that explanation. I feel that most of the evidence, the most abductive scientific approach, allows us to still understand this UFO phenomenon and this alien phenomenon, but in the context of established scientific knowledge, and especially in the context of our evolutionary history.
Very cool. Man, what great insight on this. So much better than hearing speculation of outsiders who think they have a handle on how we evolved and why we evolved. It's great to hear from somebody who can actually address this.
And it's one of the main points of the book is to really avoid speculation. And I am very cautious in this approach. I'm very quick to point out when there's something that we just can't know, you know, based on where we are in time or what data is available to us. So it is really a reserved approach that tries to buck this trend of speculation and really understand the phenomenon based on the science.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to True Car and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local True Car certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You get to ask all the questions you have and get the answers you need, so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a brand new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. All right, we're back. Dr. Michael Masters, our guest, identified flying objects. That's something new. It's an interesting way to look at this. And, you know, I'm totally open to the concepts of reexamining what we believe in this world of anomalous experiences. And UFOs certainly capture the attention of a lot of people. You know, everything from the 1950s saucer movies through Close Encounters to Starman and Star Wars, Star Trek. Our want, need, and desire to believe there's something that lives beyond this planet. Let me ask you then, knowing how vast the universe is, and I know that you've got a different take on what it is we may be experiencing, what do you believe are the chances that we are also being visited by alien species from other planets, universes, or galaxies?
Right. That's actually, you know, a big part of the book, because I can't, there's no way I could legitimately make this argument with this new model, this more abductive approach based in time and time travel, if I didn't address the extraterrestrial hypothesis. So a good part of the book, a solid two chapters, and then later on in the book, it comes back to this as well, looks at astrobiology and research in astrobiology and the sheer distances between planets, between solar systems, most importantly, because a lot of times when you hear people talk about extraterrestrials and, you know, coming from other places, they really skirt the issue of just how far apart all of these different stars are. I mean, Alpha Centauri, you know, 4.5 light years doesn't sound like very much, 4.5, but it's the speed at which light travels in 1 year, and light moves at 300,000 kilometers per second. So we're talking about huge, huge distances, and we know there's no life on Alpha Centauri, and the Kepler mission has found many, many other planets, and, you know, we've found potentially habitable planets even that are in that Goldilocks zone around their own sun, around those stars that they orbit. But they're not only far away, the characteristics of those planets, and especially their size, makes it almost impossible that a bipedal creature, a humanoid, upright walking creature, could have evolved on those planets. Like I mentioned, we suffer from bipedalism here, these perils of bipedalism. So if you add extra gravity to a planet that's denser or larger that creates a stronger gravitational field, it's extremely unlikely that any two-legged, bipedally walking creature would evolve, or that it would have the same number of hands, the same number of feet, the same number of fingers, their eyes, nose, mouth in the same location. So I am not at all doubtful that life exists on other planets. I am extremely doubtful that the UFO and alien phenomenon has anything to do with humanoid creatures that evolved on a separate planet. Those I think should be considered separately. There's undoubtedly life on other planets. It happened here on Earth as soon as it could have, as soon as we got a crust and an ocean and an atmosphere and a crust that wasn't just volcanoes everywhere. We saw life arise 3.7 billion years ago in a very simple unicellular form. So I have no doubt that life exists on many, many other planets, but I don't think that this phenomenon has anything to do with that at all.
All right. Good point to bring in. Like I said, I just wanted to kind of look at that. Now, you do have these people that witness these beings. And as you said, it's kind of interesting to consider, you know, especially these spindly beings with very thin arms, legs, you know, things. How could they live in a gravitational planet that would be stronger than ours, right? Because right. It seems like that would pull them apart. But there are planets that have lighter gravitational pulls, right? And isn't Mars one of them, that their gravity is not nearly as dense as ours? So a movement, a simple movement we do here might launch us much further on a planet like that. So if something did evolve and begin there, they might have these looks.
I mean, potentially, yeah. The thing is, the what I was making reference to are the exoplanets that the Kepler mission has so far identified. Almost all of them, almost all habitable planets or potentially habitable planets are a good bit bigger than Earth. Some much, much bigger, but they're still rocky planets. They're not gaseous planets like Saturn or Jupiter or others. But I don't know what the gravitational pull of Mars is. There are some indications that life could have existed there, but again, it's important to differentiate between life in a simple unicellular prokaryotic form and life like what we see on Earth, and especially humanoid, bipedal humanoid life. So yeah, even if there was life on Mars and it would have, you know, evolved to have been more complex, you know, maybe you have the opposite situation. Instead of, you know, two legs being not enough on a high gravity planet, maybe they would have just flown or floated or evolved spring-like legs for jumping long distances. It's hard to tell what characteristics would arise. And I'm very careful in the book not to speculate about what types of environments here on Earth in the future and on other planets would contribute to specific physical characteristics. I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make in talking about the future, is to say, well, you know, we would evolve this sort of eye form to deal with this sort of sunlight thing when we live in space, or anything that you could come up with that might influence physical traits. This book instead focuses on the long-term evolutionary trends, such as increased brain size, increased cranial globularity, meaning a more rounded, more forward projecting skull, more balloon headedness, essentially, our retracting lower faces, increase in eye size that has occurred in association with increased cerebral development or growing a larger brain. It also looks at the process of self-domestication, how we've created a lot of characteristics in ourselves that we see in other domesticated animals like dogs and cows and sheep, which is a process that's been occurring over the last 80,000 years and is likely to continue based on social changes, political changes. Looking at patterns of cranial facial feminization, how we're becoming more feminine in our characteristics, both females and males, and how that's been a recent trend that's also likely to continue for many of these same reasons. So,
see, I thought Tim has been looking prettier and prettier lately, but I well, thought maybe yeah. It was just a problem I was having.
No, he's getting prettier. We yeah. all are, as a matter of fact.
Look at you, Tim.
Well, yeah.
All right, so, you know, here's the one thing I've got to fight you on, though, Doc. If this is the way it really goes, that we got a bigger brain because we began standing upright and we were bipedal. More and more people are now hunching and bending over again, forced to watch those stupid cell phones. Are you sure we're not going to de-evolve?
Yeah.
Go back to knuckle dragging, mouth breathing, and smaller brains.
Right. There's a funny image of that same thing happening, where it's the evolutionary line, the same one I use on my book cover, in fact, that, you know, we progress, we get more upright, and then it ends with a guy hunched over his computer. The brain size thing is much more complex than I stated, just because it's, you know, it takes a lot of time to explain and the different angles and the different things that are happening there. But As we became upright walking, that initiated, or at least contributed significantly to allowing more space in the skull as our heads rotated down, our basic crania flexed, as I mentioned. But beyond that, a lot of subsequent changes in our brain size and its complexity, its reorganization that gives us this higher level thought, actually came from the benefits of having a brain and having culture and being able to adapt to problems in our environment using that intellect and using that highly complex brain, as opposed to the slow process of biological evolution that other animals that don't have culture are forced to exist with. So in looking at brain size, you know, there's been this ebb and flow. Sometimes it jumps, it gets bigger. Actually, over the last 10,000 years, it's been getting smaller, as are the rest of our bodies has decreased in size too, since largely becoming agricultural groups and because of sociocultural changes. But it's mostly a shape thing. Our brain shape has been the main thing that's given us our intellect, as our neurocortex and especially the frontal lobe behind it as that expands and moves forward, that's what gives us the ability to talk about these things and to talk about and to interact in more complex ways. So I clearly think our brains will continue to get bigger, but it's mostly that shape change. And that's what you see most commonly reported among these extratempestrials, is they have these big bulbous brains, very large eyes that kind of wrap around their heads, small noses and mouth, really narrow pointy chin, and then yeah, some characteristics in their body size. There's more variation to that. Some report them being 5 feet tall, some report them being 6.5, almost 7 feet tall, but they all still have that same cranial facial form. They all still have that same globular neurocranium and tiny face and big eyes. That's almost ubiquitous across all reports. And that, more than almost anything else, really indicates that they're just our distant human descendants.
All right. We've got to take a quick break. We're going to join back in. But, you know, this opens up. And, Tim, this is something that, you know, we haven't ever discussed before on the show regarding the encounters with aliens. Why would we be so secretive and quiet? If there really were creatures from other planets, you'd think we would be more willing to talk about it. But what if it's us?
Yeah. Right?
What if what we've uncovered is us, and that's why there's much more secret being held? We'll discuss that. We'll discuss more when we return, talking about identified flying objects here with the good doctor. Stay tuned. But first, it's time for Theater of the Mind.
Today's Theater of the Mind comes from the cataclysmic real-life encounter of Jared Hardy. Just let go. My name is Jared, and this is my story. I awoke to a strange chill that seemed to surround my entire form. I tried in vain to open my eyes, to open my mouth, but I was unable to. My first thought was, oh, this is the sleep paralysis thing I always hear about. And I tried to ride out the uneasy feeling. But that's when I noticed that through my closed eyes, I could see a blue hue seeping through my eyelids. It was no longer dark in my room, but lit up in a calming, cool, blue haze. Am I dead? Was this why I couldn't open my eyes, call, or even move? I felt the coldness caressing me like gentle waves, and then the panic began to grow inside me. I was dead. That was the only thing that could explain this cold. My mind raced, and I felt terror rise up in me like I'd never experienced. I would never get to say goodbye to my family, to feel my daughter's little hand against my face, to hear her giggles, feel the warm embrace of my wife, or the inviting hugs of my mother. This was it, and I was not ready to let go. I began praying in my head, begging to be put back, to be given one more chance. I bargained. I promised. I swore my allegiance to God to just spare me at least long enough to come back and say goodbye. Then I felt this crackling energy around me. It was still ice cold, but now it felt like low levels of electricity were coursing over my frame. Were they using the paddles of life to bring me back? To revive me? God, please let them revive me. Please bring me back, I screamed silently inside my dying shell. My eyes began to flutter. I could open them, but was surrounded in this bright blue light. I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't feel my body weight. I was light. I was floating. No, 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 no. I'm leaving my body. I'm going to the light, the goddamn light. I don't want to go to the light. I want to stay here. I just want to stay here. I kept crying out in my altered state of consciousness. They had said, when death comes for you, it will be peaceful. This was not peaceful. This was the farthest thing from it. This was abject terror. I was not prepared or willing to go. I noticed that if I turned my eyes to the extreme right or left, I could see past the brilliant blue-white glow engulfing me. I could see my room. I was hovering and floating towards my window. Then I heard the voice fill my head. My internal dialogue had stopped. This was a forceful voice, trying to seem calm. And it instructed me.
Just let go.
I refused. I cried, I prayed, and I begged. I jerked my head in a move that surprised me, and I could see behind me. My physical form was laying there, sprawled out in my bed, lifeless. My wife unaware that I was slipping away, that I was dying. Or so I thought. My head lifted and I squinted towards the light, when I saw the being beckoning me to let go. It stood just outside my window. I realized I was riding atop a bluish beam of light, and the figure kept imploring me,
"Let go."
I cursed it. I begged to give me one more day, when I noticed the whimpering coming from my physical form on the bed.
"Why won't you let go?"
it barked inside my head. Then a flood of memories came roaring back to me, like a memory hurricane. I had done this before. I had seen these beings before. I could suddenly remember being very little and seeing these faces, then being a teen boy, and then throughout other points in my life that flashed in front of me. I wasn't dying. The thought only brought me temporary relief. I was being abducted. This had been happening as far back as I could recall, always the same, always surrounded in the light, always leaving the living carcass of my form behind to be reunited later. Then came the horror of the flashes of memories, the beings' faces inches from mine, screaming, pouring over my ethereal form, shocking it, prodding it, and then the excruciating pain of being put back in my body. This time felt different. I was hovering, I was fighting, and they didn't like it. And then, with the force of being ejected from a moving plane, I heard a thrust of rushing air, like a gale force wind. And then, the unbearable, soul-shattering collision of my spirit form and my body crashing together. My chest felt like it would explode. I sat up, drenched in sweat, panting like I had run up a flight of stairs. I turned in my bed and burst forth towards the window. The son of a bitch was still standing there, feet away, glaring at me with its large, cold, dead eyes, its hairless brow furrowed in disgust. And then, the flash of white-yellow light. A loud, shattering sound exploded around me, and it was gone. My breath was still short, panting, heavy, trying to regain my composure, when my wife sat up and stared at me. "Another nightmare?" she inquired. I asked her if I had these often. She informed me that it was a few times a month. And that was when I realized this wasn't a dream or wild imagination. It was a nightmare of hellish proportions. I am an abductee.
Beyond the Darkness listeners, if you like this show, then you're going to love the Laura Ingraham Show podcast on Podcast One. Join Laura as she takes on politics and pop culture with some hard-hitting guests and takes your calls. Download the Laura Ingraham Show podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from
beyond the darkness.
Welcome back to the program. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. And our guest today is discussing identified flying objects, taking an academic approach to the UFO phenomena, maybe examining what these creatures or these beings might be, and it most likely is us from the future. I've thought that for such a long time, Doctor, and it's great to hear somebody that has the academic background to kind of back this up, so I'm not just the one lone lunatic saying this, because isn't it interesting how often these craft or beings are seen around famous times, the Pope, when that was changing over from Pope John Paul, there was they filmed it. I think it was on MSNBC or CNN. They saw the craft hovering over Vatican City.
Yeah.
And, you know, in restricted airspace. And all of a sudden it was just there.
Yeah.
And 9/11, there were a couple of UFO sightings leading up to that. There just seems to be, you know, a good record. And if we are truly going to look back at history, it would seem that if time travel does become possible, going back and reexamining history as we know it and getting it right would only make sense, and why we might have seen history show proof of what they believe to be UFOs throughout time and space, right? I mean, we see them in Renaissance art. We see them in depictions in the Bible, you know. So it also makes you wonder how much interference have we done, right? Have we gone against the prime directive of Star Trek and, you know, mucked with our own history from time to time, giving it a little bump or a tweak from, you know, here and there. But let's talk about the fact that all of these supposedly crashed crafts and these beings that have been pulled off, some are very childlike in size or stature. How do you talk about the physiology of that? Why do you believe that they would be so much smaller in some of these cases? And if they truly were alien in nature, you think that we would talk about that. But if they're finding out it's really just future iterations of us, that may be the part that you're like, all right, we have to be extremely careful, because if we admit that time travel truly does exist and that this possibility is happening right now in the future and we're visiting back, that's going to start to really create an upheaval, because people are going to be in a paranoid state. If we knew for a fact time travel existed and that the life we're leading could change at any instant by somebody coming in and stepping on a butterfly, you know, that could really upset the balance of nature here.
Well, that's a lot to unpack there.
It is.
There's about four major things in what you just said. You know, the sightings, like you mentioned, major events. World War II is probably one of the best examples, the Foo Fighters and all of the different sightings that took place around that time. And it brings up, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is this issue of, you know, what is that interaction with the past? There's bound to be rules. There's bound to be, you know, some sort of, I would guess, outright laws that monitor and regulate these intertemporal interactions. And, you know, Stephen Hawking was fond of saying he hated time travel, backward time travel. And he fought with many of his academic colleagues about this, who were, you know, demonstrating how there really aren't any paradoxes that arise, both in classical physics and also quantum mechanics, that there aren't paradoxes, there aren't changes that take place. But he hated the idea. He never got he took it to his grave. One thing he was fond of saying is that if we are going to have time travel in the future, then we would expect to be inundated by time tourists. But we don't see time tourists, therefore time travel doesn't exist in the future. And I would argue that all of these sightings are examples of that time tourism. You know, they get in, they get out, they're trying not to interact with the past too much. And going back to what you said before the break, this is a much better explanation for that behavior. If they came all the way across the universe, connecting different star systems, you would expect them to meet with the leaders of the free world and say, hey, we're from planet whatever, and we're here, and we just made this multi-thousand-year trek to be here. Hello. But you don't see that in any of these encounters. It's very secretive. It's very covert. And that makes a lot more sense in the context of not wanting to integrate yourself too much into the past. And the consensus among physicists is that you can't change anything about the future. It's already a part of the past for those members of that future. It already exists as these integrated entities that are linked across different slices of four-dimensional space-time, or what's referred to as block time or landscape time in physics. So we don't really have to worry about paradoxes arising. If something didn't happen in the past, it's just not going to happen, and it won't change your future in any way. It will be a part of your future. You will see these events. And one thing we know for sure is that if you visited yourself in the past, you will at some point when you grow up to be your older self, it's guaranteed that once you reach that point, you will go back into the past to meet your younger self. They're connected in this highly integrated time loop that exists between these different slices of block time. So there aren't really issues. You know, we don't have to worry about this butterfly effect. It's called the Novikov self-consistency principle, one of the leading researchers in the study of time travel. And he's consistently shown, and along with his colleagues, Kip Thorne, Friedman, and a number of others, that there aren't violations to causality. And that was where they really fought with Stephen Hawking, as he advocated for what was known as the chronology protection conjecture, that we need to protect the past. And all of these other researchers and, you know, classical and also quantum physics are saying we really don't. It's self-regulated. It is already existing as these integrated entities, and we don't have to worry about, you know, things like the grandfather paradox or these inconsistencies that are thought to arise when you time travel.
I wonder then if the reason some families are visited and others are not is because of some breakdown in the genetic makeup of that family lineage. Are they maybe going back to collect samples or get things that may help them, you know? So when a family is being visited by these beings, is it, you know, a chance that this could be one of their great, 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 great grandchildren that's coming back to them, you know, some version of their future selves? Why else would they be coming back to specific groups of people? And it always does seem to be, at least from a lot of the stories we've heard, generational.
Right. I would actually argue the opposite. That
how dare you? this is my show, damn it. I agree. All right, go ahead. Explain.
Well, no, it is. It's the same thing. It's just the opposite reason, I guess, that they would be coming back to visit unrelated groups, ones that they have no genetic relationship to, and likely genes that never made it into the future. And the argument made in the book, specifically, a lot of what we're talking about now is the last two chapters. The title is Intertemporal Interactions or Implications of Intertemporal Interactions. And this is an important one because you see these events play out and all of these reports. It really looks to be something like a biomedical examination. They're collecting skin samples and fecal samples, and you know, the classical anal probing idea is a big part of why that would exist. The semen samples in men is very commonly reported. And all of these things are exactly what I, as a paleoanthropologist, would do to get more information about our own evolutionary future. But also, if you look at current trends, especially in population genetics and population dynamics, we, over the last 500 years, largely since European colonialism, have become one large human population, one genetic population of interbreeding individuals on this island of Earth. And if that continues into the distant future, we may eventually reach a point at which there's sort of this global incest, this inbreeding that takes place simply as a result of there not being any other new genes. So to get to your point specifically, it may benefit us to come back in time and take some of those genes from individuals who didn't contribute to the long-term evolutionary genetic line into the future, because those are novel genes. Those are new gene variants that help you get around this problem of inbreeding and incest. And we do the same thing in managing other animal species. When we have a population in decline and a species is getting very inbred, then we'll try to like get new gene variants from very different versions of those groups and interject them into that interbreeding population. And it doesn't take very much. It takes a very small amount of new genes to really get past some of those problems with inbreeding. So yeah, when they visit specific groups, it may be sampling haplotypes that didn't make it into the future simply to get around this potential problem that would seem to exist because of current and past trends in our population dynamics.
All right. Now that too makes a lot of sense. Boy, just come in and shoot down my theories. Thanks a lot. Here I tell you, I'm glad that I can support your ideas because I believe in them. And then you just take a shot over my bow. No, so, it makes complete and utter sense, right? You want to continue the species line, but it would, you know, why wouldn't you, I don't know, why plunging so far back into the realms, but I guess you want to keep dipping into the file effects, right? Of information.
Yeah. Because and this is one of those areas where we live at a time when it may be one of our last chances to do it. We still have isolated groups. We still have groups that aren't a part of, you know, you don't have the Yanomami people hopping on airplanes and going and making babies with people in China right now. We do still have more isolated interbreeding populations. And another thing that I came across, actually, fortunately, while I was still writing the book and I was able to integrate this into the research, is the testimony of Jim Peniston during the Rendlesham Forest incident. He claims to have interacted with these beings, and they told him that they were time travelers, and they told him that they were coming back to sample genes for this very reason. And I'd already written that chapter, and then coming across that was very exciting for me, because here is this individual making this testimony, saying the same thing I'd already written about, you know, in the context of population genetics. So those two complementary accounts that come from very different places would seem to back up that claim even more.
All right. Now we kind of have a concept of why, and we're seeing these beings. You know, many of them are talking about the fact of seeing them not wearing outfits, that they're genderless skin, you know, figures. How do you start to account for that, especially when it comes to the reproductive side? Or is that part of why we're gleaning these DNA samples and pieces? We're you know, bioengineering these characters, our future selves, more like test tube babies.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, actually, because it's something I've wondered about, too. For instance, in the recreation in that the famous alien abduction video that was on Fox, you know, decades ago now. But in that recreation that they did based on the actual, you know, alleged autopsy video, there weren't really visible genitalia. And, you know, maybe they just didn't want to put a penis and vulva on, you know, this recreation for the purposes of this. I don't know. But there are other reports that also state that. One thing I do talk about in the book, though, is what's known as the obstetrics dilemma, which is basically we suffer from what colloquially among anthropologists, at least, is known as the big head, small hole problem, where we've evolved our brains to be big, but we run into this problem of still being able to get out of our mothers alive and without killing our mothers. And in many traditional societies, the infant and maternal mortality rate because of breached births and just stuck babies is upwards of 30%. 30% of women were and still are in some traditional societies dying of childbirth because of this big head, small hole problem. So cesarean section becoming more common in Western societies helps relieve some of those evolutionary pressures and may allow us to continue to grow bigger brains without the obstetrics dilemma being a problem, without still getting stuck and then having a strong selective pressure against growing brains too big too early. And if we are just cutting our babies out in the future because we have to and there's no chance for vaginal birth, that, you know, could potentially change things. I don't see how that would change anything about the basis of sex and how sex works and how babies are made. But yeah, you know, maybe it indicates that we do a little more genetic manipulation. I find it hard to believe that we would just stop having sex, though. It's a very fun thing to do.
God, I hope not.
Yeah, man. I know. That would be a terrible future. If that's the future, I don't want to live in that future.
You know, it's funny you bring up the whole vaginal birth. When my son Nathan was born 20 years ago, his mother, her only familiarity with babies was her sister-in-law, who had given birth to three boys cesarean section, right?
Yeah.
So all of them came out round and pink and happy. And I still have the video and I'll watch it from time to time just because I laugh. When they had to induce her, they had to use help. So they used this like suction cup thing, sure, that they stuck on his head to pull him out. And so when he comes out, I burst into tears. I'm like, oh, he's so beautiful. And the look on my ex-wife's face, first of all, his body is white. Yeah. His arms are purple. His legs are flaming red.
Face is smashed in.
Right. Face is smashed. And then he's got this huge alien cone head, uh-huh, going back, almost, yeah, like the aliens from, you know, the movie Aliens.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm bawling. Oh, he's so beautiful. And you can see this look of pure terror on her face. Like, oh, my God, that is, what is wrong? And I took him out in the hallway because they had to weigh him. And the family all came up and they're like, oh, is that your son? Oh, well, congratulations. They all had that same look of, what have you given birth to?
Yeah,
luckily,
you just described both of my child's births to the T. exact same situation. I'm like, oh man, like I knew that happens, you know, because the coneheadedness is right. Our way of getting around that big head, small hole problem. We have an extra suture in the front, in the frontal bone, called the metopic suture. We have the fontanelle, the soft spot at the top, and that's what allows us to do that. But yeah, they're ugly coming out right at first. You don't forget that.
No.
But it doesn't take long until their head just goes back to how it's supposed to look. But yeah, it's an important evolutionary trade-off. You know, we still wanted to grow bigger brains. We still benefited from growing bigger brains, but we also found ways of modifying our skull shape to be able to get out, at least most. Again, you know, many women aren't so lucky, and without modern technology, there's a lot that can go wrong in that process.
All right, so we've kind of got an explanation for these grays, these lanky-looking creatures. And it is interesting to also note that a lot of the original versions of alien encounters were very human-looking, maybe just a little bit. And maybe they weren't the as far advanced versions, or maybe they're the newer advanced versions. I don't know. But they would look very human in nature, maybe higher cheekbones, more defined eyes, blonde hair. You know, they I'm trying to remember, the Nordics, I think they called them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make sense, right? They're a genetic version of us coming forward. And do you think that they might fit in the evolutionary gap between us and the grays? Or
yeah,
do you think they
absolutely.
Might be the next step after the grays, and they, as we start rehumanizing or looking more like we do now?
Yeah, I mean, we see variation among humans today. We refer to it as geographic ancestry. We don't use the term race anymore because race doesn't have any biological validity. But you do see variation among humans from different parts of the world. And I talk about this in the book, too, is this variation that we see into the future the continuation of geographic ancestry, or is it temporal ancestry? Is it different stages of our future evolution? And I would be willing to guess that it's probably both. You know, there's certain more Norwegian-like characteristics, the big blue eyes, the blonde hair, are likely future humans, but also ones that have that European ancestry. Whereas you have a lot that describe them as being very Asian looking, where they have, you know, the larger, more oval shaped eyes, which is a characteristic of modern humans in that geographic region. So it's probably some combination of both. And yeah, there's really interesting examples in many of these abduction reports where they'll describe, you know, some extremely modern human just standing in the corner watching everything, you know, wearing a suit and tie and just kind of hanging out. And that indicates to me that there's more likely than not some sort of temporal collaboration too. You know, like if there's already a group coming back to, let's say, 2500 AD, you know, and there's some researchers in, 10,000 AD that are, you know, wanting to do something, and they pick them up and they come back together and they do this research. You would expect to see not just geographic variants, but also temporal variants as well. And then I think it also helps explain many of these more reptilian descriptions, or like almost bug-eyed insect-like aliens that are likely just still us, but from a very, very distant point in the distant future.
God, I just love digging into this. Now, those explanations I follow. Now, the next step, the next most popular visitor to our planet is the reptilian. These are the beings that look like a giant lizard upright, a bipedal lizard, scaly skin, slit eyes, very creepy. I want to know how we can fit them into this narrative. But first, I have to tell you that our friends at Psychic Source actually have psychic advisors who work with the police to help solve crimes. These people don't mess around. No wonder they've been around and respected services since the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was in office, folks. That's how far back they go. Psychic Source's experienced psychic advisors are available 24/7 for private, confidential readings via phone, online chat, or face-to-face video readings. 100% satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. So take a chance. Who knows? It could change your life. Not sure where to start? They have a 24/7 customer care agent to match your personality with one of their gifted psychics. Ready to give them a shot? Your first 3 minutes are free. Plus, it's only 83 cents a minute for a reading up to 30 minutes long. Just mention promo code DARKNESS when you call 1-800-355-9214. Again, use code DARKNESS when you call 1-800-355-9214, or you can sign up online at psychicsource.com. But remember to use that promo code DARKNESS, psychicsource.com. What are you waiting for? All right, Doctor, let's talk about the reptilian race then. Where do you feel these beings come from? Or is it just another, I know you said race isn't the right terminology anymore. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. To be honest, in the vast majority of reports that I came across, very few mentioned this reptilian, these reptilian characteristics. The vast majority are still extremely human-like, or occasionally, you know, insect or bug-like because of their giant eyes. But it's a pretty rare thing to report. I would argue that it's, you know, most likely an aspect of just really, really long-term human evolution. If they can travel fast enough to go back deep enough into the past to reach a point that's, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of years earlier than when they exist, we would expect to see some very different traits. I mean, in the same way that if we went back and picked up one of our Australopithecine ancestors 3 million years ago, we would look extremely different to them, and they would, you know, would most likely not think that we're them in the future. They have no concept of evolutionary change. We'd probably descend from the sky, so they'd probably assume we're from the stars, just like most people do today. But I would guess that it's either just the anxiety of the event giving people sort of a misconstrued sense of what they're really seeing, and or that may be combined with my previous argument that they're just a very distant human species.
Do you think, you know, I mean, and maybe you can explain this to me. There are people, my cousins being one, that were born with webbed hands and feet. Is this a flashback to an evolutionary period in our past? Could that be part of a reptilian aspect of who we are or will be?
I mean, you go back far enough, yeah, and we swam. You know, we had webbed digits. We're tetrapods. We have five fingers, five toes on, you know, two hands, 2 feet. And you see that in embryos too, not embryos, but fetuses, where they go through this stage of development. We have this expression that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which in layman's terms means that as we grow and develop from simple blastocysts and zygotes, that we go through this stage of development that mimics what we were as, you know, tadpoles and reptiles and, you know, early mammals and things like that. And you can kind of see it. We have this big long tail, and we have these webbed hands and feet and kind of weird alien-like faces. So, there's certain evolutionary hangovers from our deep past. A lot of babies are born with tails, and they have to snip them off. You know, like, there are things that we still have. We refer to those as ancestral traits. But for the most part, we're a very derived species, the term we use to designate these unique characteristics of our clade, the unique traits that we have as hominins. And the lack of a tail is one of those. You know, obviously we haven't had webs on our hands and feet for many, many millions of years. But those things do occasionally show up. You know, there's the shift toward not having a third molar come in at all. And about 10% of the human population today, it's not that it's impacted. It just doesn't erupt. It doesn't show up in the mouth at all. And it's been an evolutionary trend to have fewer teeth and smaller teeth. So we still see this continuing. And, you know, you could argue that having the third molar come in, you know, 20,000 years may be another one of those traits where it's just a throwback to our evolutionary past.
Okay. Now let's talk about the craft itself. You know, what about the craft and the sightings would lead you to believe that it's something from our future as opposed to something extraterrestrial out of our planet, you know, realm?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of traits. And we have this expression in biology that form follows function. And if you look at the form of, you know, the standard saucer-shaped, disc-shaped craft, and you also look at the research over the last 20 years or so in physics looking at how we actually create frame dragging, how we create the ability to reorient our light cones toward the past. And a light cone is essentially just all of the possible things that can happen within the bounds of physics because of the properties of light. And we move through this light cone along what's known as a world line in physics. But to be able to go to the past, we have to reorient those future light cones toward the past. And the vast majority of research in this area shows, you know, going back to Kip Thorne, Van Stockham with his Gödel, the Gödel universe, they all involve some sort of massive spinning disk or cylinder or sphere. And even today, you know, the modern physics research is still looking at like how you create frame dragging with the rapid rotation of masses or highly electromagnetic bodies. Like black holes are a great example. They're one of the only things in the known universe that can reverse the flow of time because they suck light back in and all things get sucked into that event horizon toward the hypothesized singularity at the inside of black holes. So that aspect of a black hole, the shape of it, the properties of it are very similar to what you see in a standard saucer-shaped UFO. And another important characteristic is the electromagnetism. The force of electromagnetism is 10 to the 40 times greater than gravity. And we think of gravity as being the strong force. It holds everything down to the earth. But it's really not. It's one of the weaker forces in physics. And electromagnetism is 10 with 40 zeros times stronger than gravity. And these UFOs tend to always have these strong electromagnetic fields reported, that they mess with car radios, they cause cars to stop, they mess with compasses. Even long after they're gone, they still change the electromagnetic properties of places where they've been. So that indicates to me two things. One, that it's an aspect of the propulsion system, that it's a way of giving these craft the ability to fly without vector-based propulsion like the jets and Bernoulli's principle with the wings that we use today, but also that it's what allows us to bend space-time enough that we can return to the past in the first place. So there's many different characteristics of these that I lay out in the book that also fit nicely with the research that's being done in physics that's investigating how to create closed time light curves and how to reorient those light cones toward the past.
Now, you know, there's a lot of people, of course, that are rolling their eyes saying, sure, that's possible, but aliens coming to our planet, that doesn't seem as feasible. The concept of time travel is exciting. It's something I love and am fascinated with, as Tim is and many of our listeners. But, you know, I mean, how far out do you think we are from actually developing technology that would allow us to do that? Or do you think we're already in the beginning stages of that? We just aren't acknowledging it now.
Well, first I'd like to address the eye rollers, because, you know, I myself am skeptical of something that seems so far detached from what our current capabilities are. But if you go back, you know, even 200-300 years into the past, going around telling people that we're eventually going to go to the moon or land all of these rovers on Mars or these comets, they would have rolled their eyes at that too. And we did it in a very short period of time. All I can do is present the evidence. All I can do is present what we know now and how that fits in with this time travel model. And I think the book does a good job of cautiously doing that, saying that this is what we know now. This is how it seems to fit with these future capabilities. And what's important, that also makes this model very different from the extraterrestrial model, is that if we are seeing these craft, and if they are us in the future, it's not about speculating. It's not about saying this is what could happen or might happen. But we're actually seeing the end result of that research. We're seeing the end result of this research into the properties of time and the physics of time travel, and even the characteristics of our future descendants. We're seeing the end result of this evolutionary process and these changes that have occurred throughout our past being projected into the future. It's not just hypothesizing about what we might look like, but we're potentially seeing that actual outcome. So, you know, I had this book reviewed by some peer reviewers, and the one who's, you know, taught quantum mechanics for 20 years and, you know, physics and theoretical physics mentioned that it would probably behoove me to mention in the opening paragraph or two, it ended up being about 5 pages, that this is what we know now. This is what we can't know. This is where we are in our understanding of time and our understanding of the physics of time travel. Just to be forthright, you know, to lay out where we are in time and what we know now and what we can't know until we get to that point that we have the technology to do it. But to answer your question, I don't think we do now. I think we have the ability to make craft that can use electromagnetism as a propulsion system. You know, you'll see all of these videos from people down at Groom Lake and all the other places where they're allegedly testing these things for a long time. And I think that is an indication that we are using many of these same technologies, but I really doubt that we have the ability to spin those things fast enough and to make them travel fast enough with their light cones oriented toward the past that we would actually be able to travel through time. I think that's going to be much, much later in our human future.
All right. I like that concept too, that, you know, this is where we're leading to. We've already seen the beginnings of this. But, you know, when you bring up the fact, hey, if you'd have pointed to the moon and said, we're going there someday, people would have rolled their eyes. But at least that's something that's a physical scope. You can look at it and say, all right, you know, we figured out how to walk from point A to point B. You know, we've now figured out by riding a horse, we can get there faster. Now steam engines, you know, trains, locomotives, all of these things are evolving. So we can continually see that we are progressing in that way. But the concept of bending time and visiting backwards, that still seems like a pretty sci-fi.
Not if you look at the research. Not if you look at the research that's being done in physics right now. They're doing it. They're looking at these frame dragging properties. We see that the Earth, even our tiny little Earth relative to these other supermassive bodies, is able to create a measurable frame dragging effect. We understand this. I think it's just that there's a disconnect between the research being done now in physics and what our conceptualization of time and time travel is. It's a huge problem in our society is that we don't talk about time. You know, St. Augustine said back in the 1600s, what is there more than time that we use every day but have no understanding of? And I'm paraphrasing actually quite poorly, but that was his main idea.
That's okay. Nobody's going to look it up to see how bad you were.
I got a quote in the book, so if they read the book, they'll see the actual quote that I didn't bastardize. But no, it's just a disconnect in our society. You know, you see it all the time in these films where there'll be something about time travel, and then at some point the writers just gave up and the characters like, yeah, I don't really know how this works. And all the other characters like, yeah, I don't either. I just saw this the other day in some show that my kid was watching. And it's, you know, it's a problem in our society. And a big focus of this book is to provide a deeper understanding of our understanding of time that exists among physicists, that exists among anthropologists as we study time. That's the main thing we do, is we study time and how culture changes over time and how humans change over time. So the book, almost more than anything else, is just about time. It's about how time works and how what we understand now about the possibility of time travel. And once you see what research is being done, it really doesn't feel any different than going from a horse to a steamship to an airplane, you know, or going to the moon. You can see that same progression, especially in looking at what I argue is the end result of that. The same properties of these craft is similar to what this research is indicating about how to actually time travel. So I think there is much more of a connection there. It's just not something that's really discussed in our society.
What are some of your favorite examples of visitations that we've had that lead you to believe that these are time travelers?
There was one that took place in, let me see if I can remember. I think it was like McKay or somewhere in Australia, where a woman was abducted. She was sucked out of a window, and there were a lot of witnesses that saw this same thing take place. And she was found, I think it was an hour and a half after I think it was McKay, Australia. This woman was abducted out of a window. Her friends were like came into the room and saw this happened, and then she was found. What was like 9 hours away, if you drove it by car, and she claimed she had been gone for several days. They took her to the hospital. They validated that. They said, yes, this woman hasn't eaten for several days. Her body hair had grown much more than what it should have for just the hour and a half that she was gone. But that, that instance in the context of time travel makes sense. You know, how could you have this woman that was gone for 3 days, but was found an hour and a half after she was abducted, 9 hours away by car? And in the context of time travel, that makes sense. You could take someone for whatever period of time, bring them back to the time that they left or the time that they were taken or shortly thereafter. And there's a number of other cases like that where people have missing time, you know, that they remember things and they remember this long history of events, but they don't really see much difference between when they were taken and when they were put back. And there's a lot of instances like that. And another thing that should also be pointed out is, especially in the context of space travel, you know, if these beings were traveling over huge distances, this would take a very, very long time. You know, they would be basically saying goodbye to their family and friends. They would never see them again. They would also have to make babies after babies after babies just to get to that solar system with some humans alive on the craft. But with time travel, you know, you could kiss your husband, your wife, your kids goodbye in the morning, go spend 2 weeks doing field research and come home 5 minutes after you left. You know, you don't have that same sacrifice that has to take place that you would have in the context of long distance space travel.
I like it, man. I hope we're on to something. We're either on to something or we're on something. That's for sure.
It could be both, I guess.
So here's the exciting thing. You're bringing this out. Do you think there's a chance you might get visited? You're helping to make this out there. Are you open to that concept?
Well, you know, the book ends with this, this conceptualization of how, if this is accurate, you know, and we do come to understand these as our future humans, if we broke down that barrier, there may not be any reason why there couldn't be overt interaction among different periods of time. You know, this sort of post-disclosure future, this idea that once we have this understanding and there are no temporal paradoxes, there are no violations to space-time, if we are interacting with ourselves across different regions of block time, then what's keeping us from doing that? And one thing I mentioned is that, you know, in the future, at whatever point they decide we're advanced enough to understand what's happening, we could potentially see people from different times in the same way that we see people from different geographic regions today. You know, you see someone with darker skin and know they're from, or at least their ancestry is sub-Saharan African, or, you know, with different cranial facial traits, and they have Asian characteristics or European characteristics or whatever. The same way we see that geographic variation today, we may, you know, interact more openly with individuals from different time periods. I feel like the secrecy, this covert activities are more an aspect of just not really understanding as a society what's going on. And so, yeah, potentially if we broke down those barriers, I would love to interact with our future humans. We could learn so much and have a much deeper knowledge of humanity and the scientific, holistic understanding of our species, not just in the past, what we see from the fossils and the stone tools, but also from just talking to them. And they could learn more from us as well. They wouldn't just have to pick us up in the backwoods of Alaska and anally probe somebody. They could say, hey, will you poop in this cup? And, you know, I'll take it back and study it.
Nearly as exotic and exciting, though.
No, it's, doctor? Well, probably for the people that get probed, I would say it's preferable. But no, it'd be a different relationship across the board. We'd have a very different relationship on both sides, as them as the visitors and us as the visited.
All right. Fantastic stuff. I'm excited. I can't wait to get the book myself to read. We're going to have a link up to your website because it's just, what is it? flyobj.com. So I know that won't be real easy to flow off the tongue, folks, so we'll make sure that we have a link up for that on today's program so you can find it a little bit more easy. And the book comes out March 1st, correct?
Well, we're hoping to have pre-sale copies. I mean, I guess that's an oxymoron because you can't get the copy in pre-sale, but the pre-sale purchase option on Monday, actually. So
excellent.
Early so, next week, they should be.
So tomorrow, to, yeah. Tomorrow yeah. It'll be available.
Tomorrow it'll be available. It may be, you know, Tuesday or Wednesday. Nothing is ever on time with right. this process as any author.
And you think with time travel and aliens, we could figure that part of it out, right?
Well, you know, there was a point when I was writing this, and I was like, man, I wish they'd just show up with this finished book so I can stop writing, you know? But that never happened.
So do you leave some room for plausible deniability so that when you're, you know, your contemporaries go, how high are you when you're writing this book? You could say, no, this is just a book of hypotheses and ideas, and it's a way to try to teach people science, but, you know, in a science fiction element.
Not at all. No, I own it. Attaboy. I own it through and through because it's a scientific book. I like I say in the first chapter, I wrote this just as much for my scientific colleagues as I did for any believer, skeptic, or anything else. I there's no reservations. I stand behind the product. I worked on it for nearly 7 years, and there's a lot of research in here, and it's written for anyone to be able to read, but it's also written for my colleagues just as much as anyone else. So no. There's no scapegoating. There's no ejection seat on this one.
I like that way to commit. You know, please let us know when you've got more books coming out. Of course, if it takes you 7 years to go ahead and do it, we might not talk again for quite a while. But this is great work, and I'm excited to hear other people talking about this. And I know I'm not the only one. I know other people have bandied this around, but it's great to hear somebody coming at it from a scientific standpoint and aspect. And I know our listeners are going to appreciate that, as opposed to just someone who has a background in dance class and pottery telling us that this is what their speculation is. Not that I'm putting those people down, but knowing that you've got the background in understanding physiology, anatomy, all of our background and where we would be going, and that it does seem to support the elements of how we would eventually progress. Do you think that because of the way some of these beings look and that they're all very similar in looks, that we're in for some kind of cataclysmic future that's going to force this evolutionary jump?
I don't know. And honestly, I don't see it really being a jump. I think the only reason it looks like a jump is because they would be coming back from discrete points in time, and we're not able to see all of the different points between now and then. So it appears to, in the same way that if you put a skull of a Neanderthal next to a modern human skull, it would seem that there's a jump there. But if you go back in our evolutionary history, you can see that long period of change that led to them and led to us as closely related subspecies. So no, I don't think I don't think that we'll really have to look at it that way, or that we need to look at it that way. I think it's the same process from the past, you know, continuing into the future. There obviously could be things that happen. There could be a nuclear war, or, you know, climate change, or anything that affects us. But again, that's not the focus of the book. I try to stay away from any sort of prediction or
right, any kind of apocalyptic future ideas.
Yeah, or just even any speculation about sure. what's going to make us look that way. We can see clear trends in our evolutionary past that have endured, regardless of our political or social or economic system, that have endured for millions of years. So I focus on those more tangible aspects of the past and try to avoid any sort of speculation about future environments.
All right, Dr. Michael Masters, thank you so much for joining us. And again, we'll have a link up for the book and the website so you can find more information. And on today's program, Identified Flying Objects, great topic. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great talking to you.
I hope you all enjoyed it as much as we did and enjoyed today's Theater of the Mind. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.